Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
I confess to spreading the rumor on orders from Goldstein that the war is not really with Eurasia, but with East Asia. And that for years, in fact, since the days of our glorious revolution, I had no faith in our future. I forged government announcements and falsified figures quoted for agricultural and industrial. As a result of mental disturbance dating from my experiences during the atomic wars, I was a willing subject of Goldstein's influence. I was stubborn and egocentric. When own life thoughts occurred to me, I reveled in them. I went into the proletarian zones. I had sex with prostitutes. I deliberately contracted syphilis. It was at this time that I made contact with the resistance. I was personally contacted by the arch-traitor Goldstein and ordered to assassinate certain inner party officials.
Bugger.
This I did. My agents forged documents and gained entry to the Ministry of Truth.
Thought crime is death. Thought crime does not entail death.
I deliberately passed.
Thought crime is death.
But the result...
I have committed, even before setting pen to paper, the essential crime that contains all others in itself.
I spent many hours of my free time encouraging my agents to deface party posters and hoarding announcements. I read and memorized Goldstein's book. For 30 years, I have plotted to bring down the party. I was sick in mind and body. Together with my colleagues, Aronson and Rutherford,
April the 4th, 1984.
In my position as chief factory,
I think.
I stole military plans and at vast financial profit sold them to the Eurasian leadership.
To the past. Or to the future. To an age when thought is free. From the age of Big Brother. From the age of the thought police. From a dead man. Greetings.
You'd better think. Come on. Think. Now was the time when we had respect. That's the thing I never will forget. Now, baby, I got a life to live and a whole lot of love that I want to give. Yeah. But before I give it up,
hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Story of Nowhere podcast. I'm your host, Daniel McCarthy, coming at you with a long overdue, off-the-cuff episode. I know it's been a while since I've done one of these, but hey, better late than never, right? But first, I will be speaking and hanging out at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest in Gaines, Michigan, which takes place between July 21st and 25th, 2022. So if you're listening to this episode when it comes out, that would be this weekend. And if you are interested in hanging out with people who are peace and liberty minded, go back and listen to my bonus episode from, I guess it would have been last August, called Peace and Liberty in the Midwest, in which I review my experience last year of the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. It was a truly fantastic time, and so I wanted to be sure to go back. So if you want to hear my review of the fest, go and listen to that show. And if you're interested in actually going and finding out where the place is and getting tickets, head over to mplfest.org. All right, so let's get on with the show. I'm going to keep this one pretty short because I've got to go out and water my garden. So it's by no means intended to be a definitive presentation or anything like that. It's just, I hope, going to be thought-provoking, to get you to consider certain ideas that maybe you haven't, or at least get you to consider them more deeply than you already have. So, This episode is going to be concerning the mainstream appropriation of certain terms which originated in alternative and even conspiratorial circles. The terms I want to talk about are patriot, woke, and of course, deep state. Now, I had originally intended for deep state to be my big closer for this episode, but instead I've decided that I want to open with it, because I want to keep this episode short, and I know that if I leave deep state for last, this will just wind up being a whole long hour-plus presentation about the deep state. So, in order to limit my discussion on that concept, I'm putting it first. So, starting with deep state, which, by the way, I also kind of laid out a little bit in the previous episode of this podcast, episode 25, in which Kevin Cole and I begin our multi-part discussion on the events of January 6th. So you can go back and check that out for some more commentary on deep state. And while that presentation, like this one, is by no means comprehensive or definitive, I think the two of them together will serve as a fairly useful introduction to the concept of deep state, at least while you await a more detailed, more nuanced, and more comprehensive analysis thereof. So, in the past few years, the term deep state has really entered into the public consciousness via the Trump MAGA movement. And in that context, as far as I can tell, it seems to just kind of vaguely refer to the permanent Washington bureaucracy. But in truth, the concept of a deep state goes, well, deeper than just that. It's a fairly old concept, originally referring to the machinations of the government of Turkey, but as a concept that was applied to the American political system, it entered into the English-speaking American consciousness largely via the work of Peter Dale Scott, who I mentioned in the previous episode, episode 25, and whose work is absolutely essential if you want to understand power in America. And in that last episode, I did read a little bit from one of Peter Dale Scott's books defining the deep state. But basically, and these are my words now, the deep state is a hidden political ecology of opportunistically cooperating and competing incentive structures involving government agents and agencies, corporations, academics, media, high finance, police and military, intelligence networks, organized crime, terrorist cells, non-state activist groups, and on and on and on. Basically, way back in episode 11, which, as you may recall, was also an off-the-cuff show, I defined political power as direct or indirect popular influence combined with control over resources. Now, I might add to this definition the willingness and ability to directly or indirectly commit violence with impunity. So this sort of power, I think, arises when groups, such as those that I just listed, work in tandem for shared ends. So the media, which influences the populace, teams up with certain corporate interests, which control resources, and then both team up with the government, which can commit violence with impunity. Now, yes, this is a gross oversimplification. I understand that. But this is basically how deep political power is generated. It's not just the government or just the media or just the corporations or just the terrorists or just the intelligence agencies, but it's complicated connections between these different entities which come together and actually give rise to deep political power. And I would contend that so many of the modern events which have shaped the modern world were actually formed and committed and carried out and covered up or whatever, not by any one of these entities, but probably by some combination of all of them. But again, I'll save the more nuanced explanation and detailed analysis of deep state for a later time. The point here is that it's an actual concept which refers to actual power and the way it works and the way different organizations interact and have historically interacted, but of course now it's just reduced to some vague aspersion to be cast by the so-called populist Trump-adjacent right wing in order to leverage the average American's disdain for the permanent Washington bureaucracy, and paint that permanent bureaucracy as comprising entirely of liberals, that is, the enemies of Donald Trump, so that Trump and his allies, in the eyes of their supporters, may be perceived as the righteous enemies and opponents of this corrupt, permanent Washington deep state. In truth, of course, their outsider status is seriously questionable. So again, the point of this episode is that certain terms whose origins are to be found in alternative, subversive, and conspiratorial political thought, including the term deep state itself, have had their meanings co-opted, watered down, or in some way altered, so that they may now serve as weapons in the arsenal of the deep state against the alternative, subversive, and conspiratorial political theories which generated them. In short, the language of the opposition has been repurposed to serve the purposes of the power elite. Let's consider the term patriot. The word patriot itself has Latin origins and concerns matters of Roman culture and statehood. But the American brand of patriotism is inextricably linked to the American founding itself. That secretive cabal of rebels who ideologically and violently opposed the crown and capital combination of the British Empire and the British East India Company could be said to have stood in opposition to the deep state of its day. More generally, they represented a provincial rejection of imperial might. But today, an Afghani rebel or an Iraqi insurgent is hardly considered a patriot. Rather, these are terrorists, though they, like the American founders before them, fight in opposition against the largest imperial force of their day, whose grasp encompasses their homelands. A patriot today is, in fact, somebody who supports the actions of the empire. A patriot waves the empire's flag and cheers as its planes, or drones, incinerate more and more provincial terrorists each day. The insurgent is only a patriot when insurgency is acceptable to the empire. Surely the Ukrainians, who've gotten permission from the United States to violently resist the Russian occupation by any means available, they're not terrorists, but patriots. Patriot, having originally indicated one who proudly and selflessly serves his fatherland, now means one who supports the prevailing and popularly accepted actions of the global empire. In America, this term, which originally denoted resistance, has now come to denote acceptance and complacence, even of the most horrid imperial and, dare I say, anti-American activities. Patriotism is no longer fatherly. It's tyrannical. It's a term inverted. Its meaning hasn't just been changed, it's been turned inside out. A patriot might today be one who turns in his neighbor for having not worn a mask at the proper time, or for having made an offensive joke on the internet. Thus, a patriot no longer serves his community, his fatherland. Instead, he serves those agencies which do little but oppress his community and all communities around the world, who would otherwise live autonomously, just as the founding American patriots envisioned their own communities might live. So that does it for patriot. As you can see, I'm moving through these at lightning speed. The next term to be addressed is the term woke. Now, here's a term you hear an awful lot these days. So it might surprise people to learn that its use actually goes back to 1938. Leadbelly, a black man and one of the early blues musicians, wrote a song about the Scottsboro Boys, a group of 9 black Alabama teenagers who were wrongly accused of raping 2 white women. So Leadbelly sang, "I advise everybody be a little careful when they go along through here. Best stay woke. Keep their eyes open." And thus began wokeness, meaning an awareness among black people that the white man may be out looking to fuck 'em over. The term was used occasionally throughout the 20th century, especially in the 60s and 70s during the civil rights and counterculture movements. it came to refer to more than just black skepticism and wariness during this period, but instead it began to refer to black consciousness in general. A 1971 play about the black activist Marcus Garvey declared, "I've been sleeping all my life, and now that Mr. Garvey done woke me up, I'm gonna stay woke, and I'm gonna help him wake up other black folk." Woke remained an exclusively black term until the early 21st century, as far as I can tell. In 2008, the phrase, "I stay woke," was used in the song "Master Teacher" by Erykah Badu, meaning something like coming to terms with reality and pursuing something better. Still, the term referred specifically to black consciousness, to black people waking up to their own identity, not the identity given to them or forced upon them by white America. At least, that's how I interpret the meaning. But now, we get into the 2010s. Now things start to change. During the original Black Lives Matter protests in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, the phrase "stay woke" was still used to refer to black awareness. In this context, awareness of alleged widespread police racism. But very shortly after this, woke as a term was thrust into the mainstream and took on a whole new and far more general meaning, I think. Between, I would say, 2015 and 2017, woke expanded to address awareness of and resistance to not only racism, but sexism, xenophobia, homophobia, transphobia, awareness of pretty much any conceivable grievance, real or imaginary, is now covered by the term woke. And I think this new wokeness, watered down, whitewashed, mainstream, airheaded wokeness, started back in 2015 at Yale, when a bunch of white, whiny, spoiled brats actually made a big stink out of people's Halloween costumes. Remember that? When they were all freaking out about how this costume's racist, that costume's racist, and so the college administration should ban certain costumes from parties? Remember those people? Really makes you wonder where all those delightful busybodies are today, doesn't it? Well, in my opinion, that was the beginning of the current social justice warrior woke movement, if you will. Since 2015, wokeness has gone from a declaration of self-direction and self-identification to an embarrassing display of oversensitivity and disingenuous posturing, both by sanctimonious individuals and by opportunistic PR groups. It's become a set of platitudes that, ironically, though unsurprisingly, people in power will use to garner support from the naive. So Burger King and BMW have rainbow Twitter profile pictures during the Gay Pride Month, and the President of the United States is apparently committed to only picking people for important positions based on what color their pussies are, rather than on merit. Because it's her turn! And because of all this idiocy, woke is now more of an insult than anything else. It's usually used by people who don't like this whole wokeness, rather than by people who do, to describe a rude, destructive, annoying, childish, privileged, self-righteous, unreflective, usually white, college-educated, left-leaning progressive who thinks the government ought to be doing more to police the thoughts, language, and jokes of normal, hard-working, everyday people of all races and all classes. Basically, someone woke today is someone who can't hang with the dock workers, when, back in Leadbelly's day, someone who was woke probably was a dock worker. Because back in his day, woke meant, hey, you better be aware and be tough, because the government is out to fuck you. Black woke strong, white woke weak. Do you see how these terms go from calling out the powers that be to ultimately serving the powers that be? Do you see how these terms begin as declarations of strength, but are then mutilated down into the whimperings of weakness and subservience? So Deep State begins as a proclamation of defiance against the left and the right, and whatever bureaucratic functions and criminal elements lie underneath it, but now becomes just the left, and so, oh, well, we better run to the right for protection. Or Patriot begins as a rallying cry against empire and against subjugation, but now just means bootlicker. Or how Woke begins as the rational awareness of the problems with powerful institutions, but then becomes a prostrate plea for institutions to be given more power over people? It's not that the original, defiant ideas behind these words have died away. It's that these ideas have been masked by the new, compliant ideas these words now point to. Because that's really all words do, is point to concepts. But the concepts don't die, even as the words change. So the ideas, the spirit of defiance is still out there and still accessible to human beings, only the way to them has been somewhat obscured because the signs or words which are supposed to point to them have been turned and flipped around every which way. Because we think in words and define concepts with words, by changing the meanings of words, certain concepts can, without ever being destroyed, be gradually forgotten. Roads can be closed, even as the houses which line them may remain. But over time, the isolated house loses that lived-in quality. It loses its definition. Sure, as an assembly of material, it continues to exist, but it returns to nature. It becomes less and less useful to human beings. This isn't a perfect analogy, of course. The house will eventually collapse. It'll cease to exist as a house at some point. But concepts, I think, remain extant so long as minds with the potential to discover them exist. But a concept lost and rediscovered will, in the mind of its rediscoverer, be somewhat dilapidated. The history which once made the concept clear in the minds of previous thinkers will be gone, and so the history may be, or perhaps must be, repeated. So, should the concept of freedom be lost, its rediscoverers 1,000 years from now will have to relearn the lessons of freedom that we have had to learn. They may have to relearn that freedom is not race-based or sex-based, as we have. They may have to learn that freedom doesn't necessarily mean hedonism, that with freedom also comes responsibility, and that freedom means freedom from incursion, rather than freedom to other people's labor and resources, all lessons we continue to struggle with today. Thus, to aid in the learning of our descendants, it's imperative that we continue to keep our concepts, our definitions, clear, polished, and in all-around good shape. And this means being conscious of the words we use and the concepts they are pointing to. Words are a means to an end, and that end is meaning. But if we don't know what the words we use mean, we risk losing touch with all meaning. We throw meaning away and leave only chains for our children's inheritance. So think about what you're saying, and think about what you're saying means, and think about what other people are saying, and what they're saying means, especially people in power. It's of the utmost importance. Now, there's a lot more I could say on this subject, and there are certainly a lot more terms and phrases and words that I think I could get into, aside from the three I just covered today. But I think what I've said here is probably enough to get the point across. So, in closing, I actually want to read to you from what I consider to be the most important part of George Orwell's 1984. And that is the appendix of the book, entitled The Principles of Newspeak. Now, obviously, even though this is an appendix to the overall story of the book, it is still referring to something that is technically fictional. That is, Newspeak, which is the language in the 1984 world of Oceania. It is, nonetheless, I think, pointing to something very, very real and very, very relevant to today's show. So, I'm actually just going to go ahead and read this appendix to you in its entirety. So, buckle up. And once again, please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already, tell some friends about the podcast, consider buying a copy of the book, and don't forget to go on over to mplfest.org to get more information on the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest if you're interested in joining me there this coming weekend. Thank you all for listening, and now let's get on into the appendix of George Orwell's 1984, The Principles of Newspeak. Newspeak was the official language of Oceania and had been devised to meet the ideological needs of Ingsoc, or English socialism. In the year 1984, there was not as yet anyone who used newspeak as his sole means of communication, either in speech or writing. The leading articles in the Times were written in it, but this was a tour de force which could only be carried out by a specialist. It was expected that newspeak would have finally superseded oldspeak, or standard English, as we should call it, by about the year 2050. Meanwhile, it gained ground steadily, all party members tending to use newspeak words and grammatical constructions more and more in their everyday speech. The version in use in 1984, and embodied in the 9th and 10th editions of the Newspeak Dictionary, was a provisional one, and contained many superfluous words in archaic formations which were due to be suppressed later. It is with the final, perfected version, as embodied in the 11th edition of the dictionary, that we are concerned here. The purpose of newspeak was not only to provide a medium of expression for the worldview and mental habits proper to the devotees of Ingsoc, but to make all other modes of thought impossible. It was intended that when newspeak had been adopted once and for all and oldspeak forgotten, a heretical thought, that is, a thought diverging from the principles of Ingsoc, would be literally unthinkable, at least so far as thought is dependent on words. Its vocabulary was so constructed as to give exact and often very subtle expression to every meaning that a party member could properly wish to express, while excluding all other meanings and also the possibility of arriving at them by indirect methods. This was done partly by the invention of new words, but chiefly by eliminating undesirable words and by stripping such words as remained of unorthodox meanings, and so far as possible, of all secondary meanings whatever. To give a simple example, the word free still existed in newspeak, but it could only be used in such statements as, "This dog is free from lice," or "This field is free from weeds." It could not be used in its old sense of politically free or intellectually free, since political and intellectual freedom no longer existed even as concepts, and were therefore of necessity nameless. Quite apart from the suppression of definitely heretical words, reduction of vocabulary was regarded as an end in itself, and no word that could be dispensed with was allowed to survive. Newspeak was designed not to extend, but to diminish the range of thought, and this purpose was indirectly assisted by cutting the choice of words down to a minimum. Newspeak was founded on the English language as we now know it, though many newspeak sentences, even when not containing newly created words, would be barely intelligible to an English speaker of our own day. Newspeak words were divided into three distinct classes, known as the A vocabulary, the B vocabulary, also called compound words, and the C vocabulary. It will be simpler to discuss each class separately, but the grammatical peculiarities of the language can be dealt with in the section devoted to the A vocabulary, since the same rules held good for all three categories. The A vocabulary. The A vocabulary consisted of words needed for the business of everyday life, for such things as eating, drinking, working, putting on one's clothes, going up and down stairs, riding in vehicles, gardening, cooking, and the like. It was composed almost entirely of words that we already possess, words like hit, run, dog, tree, sugar, house, field. But in comparison with the present-day English vocabulary, their number was extremely small, while their meanings were far more rigidly defined. All ambiguities and shades of meaning had been purged out of them. So far as it could be achieved, A Newspeak word of this class was simply a staccato sound, expressing one clearly understood concept. It would have been quite impossible to use the A vocabulary for literary purposes or for political or philosophical discussion. It was intended only to express simple, purposive thoughts, usually involving concrete objects or physical actions. The grammar of Newspeak had two outstanding peculiarities. The first of these was an almost complete interchangeability between different parts of speech. Any word in the language, in principle this applied even to very abstract words such as if or when, could be used either as a verb, noun, adjective, or adverb. Between the verb and the noun form, when they were of the same root, there was never any variation, this rule of itself involving the destruction of many archaic forms. The word thought, for example, did not exist in Newspeak. Its place was taken by think, which did duty for both noun and verb. No etymological principle was involved here. In some cases, it was the original noun that was chosen for retention, in other cases, the verb. Even where a noun and verb of kindred meaning were not etymologically connected, one or other of them was frequently suppressed. There was, for example, no such word as cut, its meaning being sufficiently covered by the noun verb knife. Adjectives were formed by adding the suffix full to the noun verb, and adverbs by adding wise. Thus, for example, speedful meant rapid, and speedwise meant quickly. Certain of our present-day adjectives, such as good, strong, big, black, soft, were retained, but their total number was very small. There was little need for them, since almost any adjectival meaning could be arrived at by adding full to a noun verb. None of the now existing adverbs was retained, except for a very few, already ending in wise. The wise termination was invariable. The word well, for example, was replaced by goodwise. In addition, any word, this again applied in principle to every word in the language, could be negatived by adding the affix un, or could be strengthened by the affix plus, or for still greater emphasis, double plus. Thus, for example, uncold meant warm, while plus cold and double plus cold meant respectively very cold and superlatively cold. It was also possible, as in present-day English, to modify the meaning of almost any word by prepositional affixes such as anti, post, up, down, etc. By such methods, it was found possible to bring about an enormous diminution of vocabulary. Given, for instance, the word good, there was no need for such a word as bad, since the required meaning was equally well, indeed better, expressed by ungood. All that was necessary, in any case where two words formed a natural pair of opposites, was to decide which of them to suppress. Dark, for example, could be replaced by unlight, or light by undark, according to preference. The second distinguishing mark of Newspeak grammar was its regularity. Subject to a few exceptions which are mentioned below, all inflections followed the same rules. Thus, in all verbs, the preterite and the past participle were the same and ended in ed. The preterite of steal was steeled, the preterite of think was thinked, and so on throughout the language. All such forms as swam, gave, brought, spoke, taken, etc., being abolished. All plurals were made by adding s or es as the case might be. The plurals of man, ox, life were man's, ox's, life's. Comparison of adjectives was invariably made by adding er, est, good, gooder, goodest, irregular forms and the more, most formation being suppressed. The only classes of words that were still allowed to inflect irregularly were the pronouns, the relatives, the demonstrative adjectives, and the auxiliary verbs. All of these followed their ancient usage, except that whom had been scrapped as unnecessary, and the shall-should tenses had been dropped, all their uses being covered by will and would. There were also certain irregularities in word formation arising out of the need for rapid and easy speech. A word which was difficult to utter, or was liable to be incorrectly heard, was held to be ipso facto a bad word. Occasionally, therefore, for the sake of euphony, extra letters were inserted into a word or an archaic formation was retained. But this need made itself felt chiefly in connection with the B vocabulary. Why so great an importance was attached to ease of pronunciation will be made clear later in this essay. The B vocabulary. The B vocabulary consisted of words which had been deliberately constructed for political purposes. Words, that is to say, which not only had in every case a political implication, but were intended to impose a desirable mental attitude upon the person using them. Without a full understanding of the principles of Ingsoc, it was difficult to use these words correctly. In some cases, they could be translated into Oldspeak, or even into words taken from the A vocabulary, but this usually demanded a long paraphrase and always involved the loss of certain overtones. The B words were a sort of verbal shorthand, often packing whole ranges of ideas into a few syllables, and at the same time more accurate and forcible than ordinary language. The B words were in all cases compound words. Compound words such as speak right were of course to be found in the A vocabulary, but these were merely convenient abbreviations and had no special ideological color. They consisted of two or more words, or portions of words, welded together in an easily pronounceable form. The resulting amalgam was always a noun verb, and inflected according to the ordinary rules. To take a single example, the word goodthink, meaning very roughly orthodoxy, or, if one chose to regard it as a verb, to think in an orthodox manner. This inflected as follows. Noun verb, goodthink. Past tense and past participle, goodthinked. Present participle, goodthinking. Adjective, goodthinkful. Adverb, goodthinkwise. Verbal noun, goodthinker. The B words were not constructed on any etymological plan. The words of which they were made up could be any parts of speech, and could be placed in any order and mutilated in any way, which made them easy to pronounce while indicating their derivation. In the word crime-think, thought crime, for instance, the think came second, whereas in think-poll, thought police, it came first, and in the latter word, police had lost its second syllable. Because of the great difficulty in securing euphony, irregular formations were commoner in the B vocabulary than in the A vocabulary. For example, the adjective forms of mini-true, mini-packs, and mini-love were, respectively, mini-truthful, mini-peaceful, and mini-lovely, simply because truthful, packsful, and loveful were slightly awkward to pronounce. In principle, however, all B words could inflect, and all inflected in exactly the same way. Some of the B words had highly subtilized meanings, barely intelligible to anyone who had not mastered the language as a whole. Consider, for example, such a typical sentence from a Times leading article as Old Thinkers Unbelly Feel Ingsoc. The shortest rendering that one could make of this in Oldspeak would be, those whose ideas were formed before the revolution cannot have a full emotional understanding of the principles of English socialism. But this is not an adequate translation. To begin with, in order to grasp the full meaning of the Newspeak sentence quoted above, one would have to have a clear idea of what is meant by Ingsoc. And in addition, only a person thoroughly grounded in Ingsoc could appreciate the full force of the word bellyful, which implied a blind, enthusiastic acceptance difficult to imagine today, or of the word oldthink, which is inextricably mixed up with the idea of wickedness and decadence. But the special function of certain Newspeak words, of which oldthink was one, was not so much to express meanings as to destroy them. These words, necessarily few in number, had had their meanings extended until they contained within themselves whole batteries of words which, as they were sufficiently covered by a single comprehensive term, could now be scrapped and forgotten. The greatest difficulty facing the compilers of the Newspeak dictionary was not to invent new words, but, having invented them, to make sure what they meant. To make sure, that is to say, what ranges of words they canceled by their existence. As we have already seen in the case of the word free, words which had once borne a heretical meaning were sometimes retained for the sake of convenience, but only with the undesirable meanings purged out of them. Countless other words, such as honor, justice, morality, internationalism, democracy, science, and religion, had simply ceased to exist. A few blanket words covered them, and in covering them, abolished them. All words grouping themselves round the concepts of liberty and equality, for instance, were contained in the single word crime-think, while all words grouping themselves round the concepts of objectivity and rationalism were contained in the single word old-think. Greater precision would have been dangerous. What was required in a party member was an outlook similar to that of the ancient Hebrew who knew, without knowing much else, that all other nations, other than his own, worshipped false gods. He did not need to know that these gods were called Baal, Osiris, Moloch, Ashtaroth, and the like. Probably the less he knew about them, the better for his orthodoxy. He knew Jehovah and the commandments of Jehovah. He knew, therefore, that all gods with other names or other attributes were false gods. In somewhat the same way, the party member knew what constituted right conduct, and in exceedingly vague, generalized terms, he knew what kinds of departure from it were possible. His sexual life, for example, was entirely regulated by the two Newspeak words, sex crime, sexual immorality, and good sex, chastity. Sex crime covered all sexual misdeeds whatever. It covered fornication, adultery, homosexuality, and other perversions, and, in addition, normal intercourse practiced for its own sake. There was no need to enumerate them separately, since they were all equally culpable and, in principle, all punishable by death. In the C vocabulary, which consisted of scientific and technical words, it might be necessary to give specialized names to certain sexual aberrations, but the ordinary citizen had no need of them. He knew what was meant by good sex, that is to say, normal intercourse between man and wife, for the sole purpose of begetting children, and without physical pleasure on the part of the woman. All else was sex crime. In Newspeak, it was seldom possible to follow a heretical thought further than the perception that it was heretical. Beyond that point, the necessary words were non-existent. No word in the B vocabulary was ideologically neutral. A great many were euphemisms. Such words, for instance, as joy camp, forced labor camp, or mini-packs, ministry of peace, i.e. ministry of war, meant almost the exact opposite of what they appeared to mean. Some words, on the other hand, displayed a frank and contemptuous understanding of the real nature of oceanic society. An example was prol feed, meaning the rubbishy entertainment and spurious news which the party handed out to the masses. Other words, again, were ambivalent, having the connotation good when applied to the party and bad when applied to its enemies. But in addition, there were great numbers of words which at first sight appeared to be mere abbreviations and which derived their ideological color not from their meaning, but from their structure. So far as it could be contrived, everything that had or might have political significance of any kind was fitted into the B vocabulary. The name of every organization, or body of people, or doctrine, or country, or institution, or public building was invariably cut down into the familiar shape, that is, a single, easily pronounced word with the smallest number of syllables that would preserve the original derivation. In the Ministry of Truth, for example, the records department, in which Winston Smith worked, was called RecDep. The fiction department was called FicDep. The teleprograms department was called Teledep, and so on. This was not done solely with the object of saving time. Even in the early decades of the 20th century, telescoped words and phrases had been one of the characteristic features of political language, and it had been noticed that the tendency to use abbreviations of this kind was most marked in totalitarian countries and totalitarian organizations. Examples were such words as Nazi, Gestapo, Comintern, Imprakor, Agitprop. In the beginning, the practice had been adopted, as it were, instinctively, but in Newspeak, it was used with a conscious purpose. It was perceived that in thus abbreviating a name, one narrowed and subtly altered its meaning by cutting out most of the associations that would otherwise cling to it. The words Communist International, for instance, call up a composite picture of universal human brotherhood, red flags, barricades, Karl Marx, and the Paris Commune. The word Comintern, on the other hand, suggests merely a tightly knit organization and a well-defined body of doctrine. It refers to something almost as easily recognized and as limited in purpose as a chair or a table. Comintern is a word that can be uttered almost without taking thought, whereas Communist International is a phrase over which one is obliged to linger, at least momentarily. In the same way, the associations called up by a word like mini-true are fewer and more controllable than those called up by Ministry of Truth. This accounted not only for the habit of abbreviating whenever possible, but also for the almost exaggerated care that was taken to make every word easily pronounceable. In Newspeak, euphony outweighed every consideration other than exactitude of meaning. Regularity of grammar was always sacrificed to it when it seemed necessary. And rightly so, since what was required, above all for political purposes, was short, clipped words of unmistakable meaning which could be uttered rapidly and which roused the minimum of echoes in the speaker's mind. The words of the B vocabulary even gained in force from the fact that nearly all of them were very much alike. Almost invariably, these words, good think, mini packs, prol feed, sex crime, joy camp, ingsoc, belly feel, think pole, and countless others, were words of two or three syllables, with the stress distributed equally between the first syllable and the last. The use of them encouraged a gabbling style of speech, at once staccato and monotonous. And this was exactly what was aimed at. The intention was to make speech, and especially speech on any subject not ideologically neutral, as nearly as possible independent of consciousness. For the purposes of everyday life, it was no doubt necessary, or sometimes necessary, to reflect before speaking, but a party member called upon to make a political or ethical judgment should be able to spray forth the correct opinions as automatically as a machine gun spraying forth bullets. His training fitted him to do this, the language gave him an almost foolproof instrument, and the texture of the words, with their harsh sound and a certain willful ugliness which was in accord with the spirit of Ingsoc, assisted the process still further. So did the fact of having very few words to choose from. Relative to our own, the Newspeak vocabulary was tiny, and new ways of reducing it were constantly being devised. Newspeak, indeed, differed from most all other languages in that its vocabulary grew smaller instead of larger every year. Each reduction was a gain, since the smaller the area of choice, the smaller the temptation to take thought. Ultimately, it was hoped to make articulate speech issue from the larynx without involving the higher brain centers at all. This aim was frankly admitted in the Newspeak word duck speak, meaning to quack like a duck. Like various other words in the B vocabulary, duck speak was ambivalent in meaning. Provided that the opinions which were quacked out were orthodox ones, it implied nothing but praise. And when the Times referred to one of the orators of the party as a double-plus-good duck speaker, it was paying a warm and valued compliment. The C vocabulary. The C vocabulary was supplementary to the others and consisted entirely of scientific and technical terms. These resembled the scientific terms in use today, and were constructed from the same roots, but the usual care was taken to define them rigidly and strip them of undesirable meanings. They followed the same grammatical rules as the words in the other two vocabularies. Very few of the C words had any currency either in everyday speech or in political speech. Any scientific worker or technician could find all the words he needed in the list devoted to his own specialty, but he seldom had more than a smattering of words occurring in the other lists. Only a very few words were common to all lists, and there was no vocabulary expressing the function of science as a habit of mind or a method of thought, irrespective of its particular branches. There was indeed no word for science, any meaning that it could possibly bear being already sufficiently covered by the word ingsoc. From the foregoing account, it will be seen that in Newspeak, the expression of unorthodox opinions above a very low level was well-nigh impossible. It was, of course, possible to utter heresies of a very crude kind, a species of blasphemy. It would have been possible, for example, to say, "Big Brother is ungood." But this statement, which to an orthodox ear merely conveyed a self-evident absurdity, could not have been sustained by reasoned argument because the necessary words were not available. Ideas inimical to ingsoc could only be entertained in a vague, wordless form, and could only be named in very broad terms, which lumped together and condemned whole groups of heresies without defining them in doing so. One could, in fact, only use Newspeak for unorthodox purposes by illegitimately translating some of the words back into Oldspeak. For example, "all mans are equal" was a possible Newspeak sentence, but only in the same sense in which "all men are red-haired" is a possible Oldspeak sentence. It did not contain a grammatical error, but it expressed a palpable untruth, i.e., that all men are of equal size, weight, or strength. The concept of political equality no longer existed, and this secondary meaning had accordingly been purged out of the word equal. In 1984, when Oldspeak was still the normal means of communication, the danger theoretically existed that in using Newspeak words, one might remember their original meanings. In practice, it was not difficult for any person well-grounded in doublethink to avoid doing this, but within a couple of generations, even the possibility of such a lapse would have vanished. A person growing up with Newspeak as his sole language would no more know that equal had once had the secondary meaning of politically equal, or that free had once meant intellectually free, than, for instance, a person who had never heard of chess would be aware of the secondary meanings attached to queen and rook. There would be many crimes and errors which it would be beyond his power to commit, simply because they were nameless and therefore unimaginable. And it was to be foreseen that with the passage of time, the distinguishing characteristics of Newspeak would become more and more pronounced, its words growing fewer and fewer, their meanings more and more rigid, and the chance of putting them to improper uses always diminishing. When Oldspeak had been once and for all superseded, the last link with the past would have been severed. History had already been rewritten, but fragments of the literature of the past survived here and there, imperfectly censored, and so long as one retained one's knowledge of Oldspeak, it was possible to read them. In the future, such fragments, even if they chanced to survive, would be unintelligible and untranslatable. It was impossible to translate any passage of Oldspeak into Newspeak unless it either referred to some technical process or some very simple everyday action, or was already orthodox. "Good thinkful" would be the Newspeak expression, in tendency. In practice, this meant that no book written before approximately 1960 could be translated as a whole. Pre-revolutionary literature could only be subjected to ideological translation, that is, alteration in sense as well as language. Take, for example, the well-known passage from the Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of those ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, and to institute new government." It would have been quite impossible to render this into newspeak while keeping to the sense of the original. The nearest one could come to doing so would be to swallow the whole passage up in the single word, crime think. A full translation could only be an ideological translation, whereby Jefferson's words would be changed into a panegyric on absolute government. A good deal of the literature of the past was, indeed, already being transformed in this way. Considerations of prestige made it desirable to preserve the memory of certain historical figures, while at the same time bringing their achievements into line with the philosophy of Ingsoc. Various writers, such as Shakespeare, Milton, Swift, Byron, Dickens, and some others, were therefore in process of translation. When the task had been completed, their original writings, with all else that survived of the literature of the past, would be destroyed. These translations were a slow and difficult business, and it was not expected that they would be finished before the first or second decade of the 21st century. There were also large quantities of merely utilitarian literature, indispensable technical manuals and the like, that had to be treated in the same way. It was chiefly in order to allow time for the preliminary work of translation that the final adoption of Newspeak had been fixed for so late a date as 2050. The end.